Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for November 25th. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Trump Urges Action After Chicago Shooting, written by Carissa Waddick. President Donald Trump revived calls to ramp up the federal government's military crackdown in Chicago after a 14-year-old was killed and 8 other teenagers were wounded during weekend shootings in the city's bustling downtown corridor. In a November 22nd Truth Social post, Trump described massive crime and rioting in downtown Chicago and argued Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson were refusing federal government help for a situation that could be quickly remedied. The people are chanting, "Bring in Trump," he said. Gunfire erupted November 21st about 10 p.m. local time, just 2 blocks from Millennium Park. Hours earlier, thousands had gathered in the park to watch fireworks and listen to live music during the city's Christmas tree lighting ceremony. Johnson said the shots appeared to ring out during a teen takeover that brought large crowds of young people into the city. Officers nearby saw a large group on the sidewalk that began to scatter after the shots were fired, the Chicago Police Department said in an email to USA Today. They are still investigating the cause. When they arrived at the scene, authorities found 7 teenagers ages 13 to 17 wounded. Less than an hour later, officers found 2 other teenagers with gunshot wounds blocks away. One of them, Armani Floyd, 14 years old, died of his injuries, according to the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office. Incidents like last night set us back as a city, and it evokes fear, Johnson said of the violence during a November 22nd news conference. He described the shooting as emotional whiplash from the cheerful mood downtown during the tree lighting. Our young people have to understand that they should not attend these unauthorized events that have been advertised on social media, Johnson said of the teen takeover. The event was promoted on social media a week before the deadly incident, and police had been monitoring the conversation, Johnson told reporters. He said the city placed 700 extra police officers and violence intervention specialists in the streets around the expected gathering place, but admitted the precautions did not do enough. I'm the first person to recognize that we have more work to do in this city to provide safe spaces for our young people, Johnson said. When we have a setback like this, it just reminds us of the long road we have to build the city we all want to live in. Trump's comments come days after the Pentagon withdrew some National Guard troops the president sent to Chicago and Portland, Oregon, as part of his national crackdown on illegal immigration and crime in Democratic-led cities. The withdrawal of troops was part of a strategy to ensure long-term presence in each city, the U.S. Northern Command said in a post on X. Trump initially deployed troops to Chicago in September when he launched what he called Operation Midway Blitz. During clashes with residents, federal agents used pepper balls and tear gas and hit journalists, a pastor, and officers with the Chicago Police Department, according to reports and a lawsuit. Trump called for the arrests of Pritzker and Johnson for failing to protect ICE agents. In one incident, Border Patrol agent shot and wounded a U.S. citizen. The next article is entitled, E. coli outbreak at Arizona State Fair may have started with a pig. Written by Robert Anglin. At least four children hospitalized with a virulent strain of E. coli touched a pig at the Arizona State Fair's petting zoo days before they got sick, their parents and advocates say. The pig was part of the fair's Great American Petting Zoo, which encouraged families to get up close and personal with furry and fuzzy friends, but did not include hand-washing stations attached to the exhibit. County health officials confirmed to the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com that investigators identified the fair as a possible source of infection, which reportedly sent dozens of the kids to emergency rooms and left several in acute kidney failure. Fair officials have acknowledged they were made aware of several E. coli cases and were working with county and state investigators. But state health officials have been mum on the petting zoo and any possible contamination through a pig. The lack of information has left parents to piece together how their kids were infected through conversation with nurses and doctors, health investigators, and representatives of a nonprofit group that first raised alarms about the fair. "My daughter did go to the petting zoo, and she did pet a pig," said Jenna Tribus of Phoenix, whose 12-year-old daughter spent nearly 3 weeks at Phoenix Children's Hospital undergoing two blood transfusions and dialysis after her kidneys shut down. "Doctors and nurses were asking everybody if they had gone to the fair," Tribus told the Republic. "It seemed like the petting zoo and the fair was a common denominator." The Arizona State Fair in Phoenix ran from September 19th to October 26th. More than 1 million people attended. Petting zoos are notorious for outbreaks of an E. coli strain known as STEC, which causes vomiting, bloody diarrhea, cramps, and dehydration that can lead to kidney failure. Outbreaks have been repeatedly traced to fairs, farms, and zoos, including one at the San Diego County Fair in 2019, responsible for the death of a 2-year-old. Bill Marler, the world-renowned food safety lawyer in Seattle, has tracked E. coli cases for years. Fairs, petting zoos, and other animal exhibits have been increasingly linked to E. coli, he warned in a fair and petting zoo safety sheet on his website. After a 2023 outbreak at the Tennessee petting zoo, Marler wrote online, "Here we go again. Seven children were hospitalized." The exact number of E. coli cases tied to the Arizona outbreak is unknown. Tribus said doctors at Children's Hospital told her the hospital treated more than 100 kids sick with STEC. At least 8 children, including her daughter, were hospitalized with hemolytic uremic syndrome caused by the STEC, she said. "While we were there, there were 8 going through dialysis," she said. "One doctor came in and said over 100 kids got sick." Officials with the Arizona Department of Health confirmed the E. coli outbreak without acknowledging a geographic tie, the scope, the potential source, or a number of cases. In general terms, they said the department saw a 2-fold increase of E. coli cases statewide in October. "There has been an increase in hospitalizations involving hemolytic uremic syndrome, a serious complication linked to this infection," DHS Media Director J.P. Martin said in a November 18th email. Tribus said her daughter attended the fair October 26th with her father. She started getting sick 3 days later and was hospitalized November 1st after blood in her stool tested positive for SDEC. Her daughter was unable to keep anything down. Her condition worsened. Blood work showed toxins from the E. coli were destroying her red blood cells. She ended up on a feeding tube. "It was terrifying," Tribus said. "It's your kid, your baby. It was really bad. It was shocking how bad it got." Her daughter was released from the hospital November 18th. Finally, she did recover her kidney function," Tribus said. "I feel really lucky that she is getting better." What happened to Tribus's daughter is remarkably similar to accounts other parents shared with a nonprofit group that supports children affected with HUS. Officials at Tennessee-based Parker's Promise were the first to publicly tie the outbreak in Arizona to the state fair and raise concerns about the petting zoo. They said multiple parents reported that their children got sick after petting a pig there. "It is the pig," Marty McGonigal Martin, vice president of the organization, said. "We've confirmed 4 kids, but I'm sure there were more who petted the pig." The group focused on the pig after hearing from Summer Lee of Gilbert, whose daughter was hospitalized for 4 days with STEC. Lee told the Republic her 16-year-old daughter stopped to pet a pig inside the zoo enclosure while at the fair October 26th with her boyfriend. "It was the only animal she touched. Her boyfriend, who did not touch the animal, did not get sick." Investigators with the state and county health departments interviewed her daughter about the exposure and indicated the petting zoo could be a possible culprit, Lee said. McGonigal Martin said parents reported the petting zoo had only hand sanitizer stations attached to the exhibit and had signs directing them to nearby bathrooms. "Hand sanitizer does not kill E. coli," she said. "The Arizona State Fair in the future needs to have hand washing stations as you leave the zoo, not just signs." Fair officials confirmed November 21st, there are no hand washing stations with soap and running water attached to the exhibit. There are some nearby. Fair spokesperson Brianda Martinez said the petting zoo is located in the fair's agriculture building. She said there are hand washing stations and full restrooms inside the building and close to the petting zoo. But hand sanitizer is all that is available at the zoo. Martinez said the same vendor, Great American Petting Zoo, has run the petting zoo at the fair for more than 15 years. Other vendors provide different animal attractions, such as farm tours, ag display, camels, and birds. The zoo is operated by a company called Great American Entertainment in Stephenville, Texas. A representative on November 21st declined to answer questions about the E. coli outbreak or say if health inspectors had contacted them before hanging up. Petting zoos might seem benign, a bucolic place for families with goats, pigs, and other docile farm animals running under the feet of children, but they are high risk and a dangerous activity, McGonigal Martin said. Does she intentionally mean to make zoos sound scary? Yes. You better scare people because there is a real scare here, she said. There are ways to make petting zoos safer, such as requiring soap and water at each enclosure or mandating paper gowns and booties for anyone entering an animal pen, she said. The point is to minimize exposure to poop, which is where E. coli lives. E. coli is found in the environment, foods, and intestines of people and animals. Some strains of E. coli aren't dangerous, but others can be fatal. It can cause infections, pneumonia, and kidney failure. E. coli typically spreads through contact with contaminated food, but it can be transmitted through people or animals. Most people infected with E. coli experience diarrhea, severe stomach cramps and vomiting, and recover within 1 week. Children younger than 5, older adults, and people with weakened immune systems are more likely to develop hemolytic uremic syndrome. It takes an average of 3 to 4 days to get sick after eating food infected with E. coli or coming into contact with it through animals, but it can take up to 8 days for symptoms to develop. Trebus has no idea what her daughter's hospitalization will cost or how much of it insurance will cover, but she knows it is going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars. She said her initial out-of-pocket at Children's was $2,300 and expects that was based on whatever copay her insurance requires. But she wasn't thinking about money when her daughter was suffering. "I assume more bills are coming," Trebus said. McGonigal Martin acknowledged the costs can be overwhelming, and parents often have little recourse because state laws protecting agritourism can give legal immunity to farms, fairs, and zoo operators. About 31 states have some version of the law, including Arizona. Parker's Promise has organized fundraisers for families facing mounting legal bills. McGonigal Martin said the group helped a single parent who was hospitalized for 2 months and could not pay rent. The group's mission is to help parents while their children are hospitalized. It provides emotional support, medical guidance, and education about dangers of what the group calls environmental pathogens, of which STEC is one of the worst. The organization was founded in 2023 by Morgan Stein, a physician's assistant whose 7-year-old son Parker got STEC at a Tennessee farm camp a year earlier, according to the agency's website. He was hospitalized for 8 days. One of his jobs at the farm was caring for a baby goat. 14 people became ill in the E. coli outbreak, and the 2-year-old boy died. The work also is personal for McGonigal Martin, a retired high school counselor whose 7-year-old son was hospitalized for 56 days in 2006 with an E. coli infection that turned into hemolytic uremic syndrome. Part of what is driving her is advocating policy change and passing mandated safety standards for fairs and petting zoos. The next article is entitled, "Labor Department is Cutting Migrant Farm Worker Wages," written by Clara Magoya. 18 farm workers and their union are suing the U.S. Department of Labor over a new rule that slashes wages for foreign agricultural workers across the country and, the union argues, would undercut U.S. workers. The federal agency's new rules, published in early October, would lower up to 20% the wage requirements for a visa program called H-2A, which allows farmers and labor contractors to bring in migrant workers for seasonal jobs. In Arizona, The guest worker program brings about 33,000 migrants to work on Arizona ranches, farms, and at plant nurseries every year. They make up about 18% of Yuma's agricultural workforce during the winter months. The majority of the workforce, however, is made of permanent residents or naturalized citizens, many of whom live in Sonora, Mexico, and cross the border daily, about 5 hours before sunrise, to harvest the crops of the U.S. winter salad bowl. Under the new rules, farmers and labor contractors can pay men and women with H-2A visas $15.32 per hour instead of $17 for work done in Arizona fields. They can also take $2 of their salary to pay for housing that they are obligated to provide under law. The American Farm Bureau celebrated the new rules announced by the federal agency in early October as a positive step forward to agricultural reform and one that will keep U.S. farms afloat as labor costs rise. United Farm Workers described it as one of the largest wealth transfers from workers to employers in the U.S. agricultural history. The Farm Worker Union claims the rule would immediately lower wages for domestic workers, too, and make it easier for farmers to hire foreign workers over workers already in the United States. There is nothing America first about expanding exploitative guest worker programs that undercut and displace American workers, said Teresa Romero, president of the United Farm Workers, in a statement. If this president will not fight for American farm workers, then we will. Farm work is tough, and there aren't many people in the United States willing to do it. In that, grower groups and farm worker advocates agree, but when it comes to labor and immigration reform, amidst the Trump administration's massive deportation policies and U.S. farms' dependence on migrants, there is tension. U.S. agriculture runs on a workforce of about 2.5 million men and women, about 1 million of them undocumented, others naturalized with permanent residency or native-born from migrant families. On top of these workers already in the United States, farmers and labor contractors bring nearly 400,000 people under H-2A visas to keep food production afloat. Without these immigrants, we would struggle, said dairy farmer John Rosenau in the launch of a national farm-led campaign that seeks to bring attention to the need of long-term solutions to agriculture labor and immigration reform. The ongoing farm labor crisis threatens food production in the United States, the coalition says. The country is already dependent on imported foods, but that could worsen if there aren't enough migrant workers to keep the U.S. farms' production afloat. Calls for reform have gained new urgency as the Trump administration continues its immigration crackdown. ICE agents have detained field workers at dairy farms in Vermont and New Mexico, at numerous farm fields in California counties, in two cannabis farms, a citrus orchard, an Oregon blackberry farm, and an Alabama poultry plant, according to a list collected by Civil Eats. A farm in Camarillo, California, where 361 workers were arrested in July, reported a loss of millions of dollars. Labor advocates have expressed concerns that grower groups are using raids as an excuse to make changes to the guest worker program and make it easier to bring in foreign labor, instead of improving conditions for American workers and protecting the over 1 million undocumented workers who have long sustained the industry. For decades, there have been attempts to create a pathway for citizenship for this undocumented workforce. For the third time in a row, the latest version of a Farm Worker Modernization Act was introduced in the House of Representatives with compromises from Democrats, Republicans, grower groups, and the Farm Worker Union. But it hasn't had a hearing. Growers already achieved some of their asks with the Department of Labor rule. The wages, which increased during the Biden administration, threatened to put many farms out of business, grower groups claimed. Labor costs can make up to 40% of the farm production expenses, especially as dependence on the guest worker program grows. The industry has struggled to retain and attract domestic workers for this seasonal and physically demanding work, and much of its current workforce is aging, so it increasingly relies on contracting needed workers under the H-2A visa program. The program is bureaucratically complicated and expensive, critics say, and has grown sevenfold since 2005 without meaningful reform. The rapid growth, without a robust system of checks or more federal inspectors, has also created a system where abuse against foreign workers goes unchecked, the critics say. After covering transportation, housing, and federally mandated wages, some farms are looking at costs of $29 an hour for H-2A employees, one Northern California farmer told USA Today. Rising labor costs outpace what he gets for his apple sales. Even with thousands of people willing to cross the border every day to work in Yuma's fields, farms struggle every year to find enough people for the harvest season. "We're short of folks. We've always been," said John Boltz, president of the Arizona Farm Bureau and owner of Desert Premium Farms. "Without the guest worker visa program, farmers would be in a very bad spot." "A lot of folks have adopted H-2A to fill the gap," he said, "and the gap is mighty." The next article is entitled "Exorcisms Discussed by Phoenix Bishop in Episode of CNN Special," written by Jose Gonzalez. A call from CNN led Roman Catholic Diocese Bishop John Dolan to discuss a topic on which he usually prefers to stay mum, exorcisms. Dolan was featured in a new episode of CNN's The Whole Story with Anderson Cooper, in which the bishop said he spoke on the importance of prioritizing mental health care. Dolan believes in the practice of exorcisms within the Roman Catholic Church, and there is a priest who secretly serves as the Phoenix Diocese's designated exorcist. Still, the bishop emphasized that psychology should be a primary resource when addressing concerns about demonic possession. "We clergymen are not up to speed on psychology and psychiatry, and I think we need to get there before we start talking about something that lies beyond science," Dolan said. This frame of thinking aligns with the purpose of the Phoenix Diocese Mental Health Ministry, which began under Dolan's direction shortly after he became bishop in 2022. The ministry's three goals are to educate, accompany, and advocate. Earlier in November, Dolan spoke at a conference at the Vatican about the ministry's work. Through the help of psychiatrists, the diocese assesses whether those who believe they are victims of possession may instead be suffering oppression distress stemming from a psychological trauma like PTSD or paranoid schizophrenia. Dolan said the vast majority of suspected cases of possession are actually oppression. We want to make sure that science, the science of psychology, is given a fair shake, Dolan said. A CNN producer reached out to Dolan's office to request participation in the episode after shifting focus upon learning of the diocese's mental health ministry, according to Brett Meister, diocese spokesperson. David Culver, a CNN national senior correspondent, traveled to Arizona to talk with Dolan, Roman Catholic Diocese of Tucson Bishop Emeritus Gerald Kincarnas, and a practicing exorcist, according to a news release from the cable network. Titled The Exorcists, the CNN episode will premiere at 6 p.m. Arizona time, November 23rd. As captivating to the public imagination as exorcisms may be, Dolan is concerned the attention they garner may erode all the many other works of the Church. The expulsion of demons was part of the mission Jesus Christ had when he walked the earth, Dolan said. However, the bishop quickly noted there were other great miracles performed by Christ, such as healing the blind, feeding the multitudes, and curing the sick. He wasn't stuck on any of those things. He didn't come to feed the multitudes. He didn't come to expel demons, Dolan said. If we focus only on those elements, we get bogged down on our own mission. Dolan characterized the way Hollywood has depicted exorcisms as sensational. He said he worries about believers' interest and excitement in the potential of an exorcism. Partly for this reason, the identity of the Phoenix Diocese resident exorcist is not widely known. Dolan said he has seen throughout his pastoral career how some clergymen have made exorcisms their sole focus. At Dolan's urging, priests will offer those who believe they are possessed with the sacrament of the anointing of the sick, whose purpose is to bring physical and spiritual healing to the ill. An exorcism is sacramental, but it is not one of the seven Catholic sacraments, which include baptism and marriage, Dolan said. We have at our fingertips as priests the wonderful gift of the anointing of the sick, which is a tremendous gift, Dolan said. That's far greater than exorcism. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, Kirk Says Report for J.D. Vance is in the Works, written by Stephanie Murray. Turning Point's support of Vice President J.D. Vance is in the works for the 2028 presidential race, Erica Kirk told conservative commentator Megyn Kelly at her Glendale Live show. That was a thing that my husband was very direct about, Erica Kirk said. It was, interestingly enough, one of the last few conversations we had was how intentional he was about supporting J.D. for 28. Erica Kirk was the wife of Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist who was assassinated 2 months ago. She discussed her husband's death and the future of his political organization in an hour-long sit-down with Kelly. She appeared with Kelly at Desert Diamond Arena in Glendale on November 22nd. Thousands of people attended the event, which was the final stop on Kelly's nationwide tour. Charlie Kirk was the architect of Turning Point, a network of conservative groups aimed at bringing young people into the conservative movement. The organization was credited with boosting turnout for President Donald Trump in the 2024 presidential race. Kelly pressed Erica Kirk several times about whether her organization would back Vance in the upcoming presidential primary. Erica Kirk said she was still enjoying Trump's 2024 win, but noted Charlie Kirk was a close Vance ally. He boosted Vance's Ohio Senate campaign and encouraged Trump to choose him as his running mate. The vice president and second lady, Usha Vance, escorted Charlie Kirk's casket from Utah to Arizona in September. Charlie Kirk was shot and killed September 10th at a Turning Point event on the Utah Valley University campus in September. He was 31 when he died. We always knew that there were people out there that hated us with deep, deep passion of hate, but it didn't scare us, Erica Kirk said. We always lived as if it was our last day. Utah man Tyler Robinson was charged with his murder. We're here to make sure his assassin, the people who laughed about it, the people who celebrated it, get the message. Erica Kirk took over as chair and CEO of Turning Point USA after her husband's death. Erica Kirk said that in August, Charlie Kirk had discussed with donors the future of Turning Point if he was ever killed, and he said, Erica will do a great job running it. She told Kelly she's not afraid to be a single mother or run a company because she saw her mother do these things as a child, but noted she is very conservative and Turning Point will never become feminized. Discussing their relationship, Erica Kirk said she was living in New York City and had a career-focused mindset before she began dating Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk beautifully saved me from a huge mistake of putting career over family, Erica Kirk said. The couple have two young children but wanted more, she said. I wanted to have four, and I was praying to God that I was pregnant when he got murdered, Erica Kirk said. Now when I see young couples, I tell them, please don't put it off. Erica Kirk also discussed other topics, including her Christian faith, her opposition to transgender people playing in girls' sports, her late husband's forthcoming book, and her viral hug with Vance at a recent Turning Point event. If you want to take that out of context, go right ahead, Erica Kirk said. That, to me, shows that you need a hug more than anyone else. Erica Kirk also brushed off the vitriol and controversy theories she's faced in the wake of her husband's death. I'm okay with the world not understanding me, Erica Kirk said. Kelly also asked her about more lighthearted topics, including the fact that she does not have hair extensions. The show had the hallmarks of a Turning Point promotion, including a pyrotechnic display when Erica Kirk and Kelly took the stage. Earlier in the evening, comedian and singer Jason Hewlett performed a song tribute to Charlie Kirk, who he said changed his life. We are Charlie, Hewlett sang, alternating between singing and playing a harmonica. Some people in the crowd held up their smartphone flashlights. At another point, Turning Point chapter members came on stage to a pyrotechnic display and tossed baseball hats into the crowd. comedian Jacob Taliaferri told a story about how Charlie Kirk brought him on as Turning Point's jokester. He also told a series of jokes, including one about commenting "That's gay" under picture of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Comedy and jokes and humor is what we need to fight to be able to continue to do, because that is an extension of the thing Charlie fought the hardest for, Taliaferri said. The stage was decorated with large floral arrangements with white, pink, and green flowers. Kelly-branded tissues were set on a table between Erica Kirk and Kelly's chairs. Frank Turek, a Christian author and Charlie Kirk's mentor, linked the September shooting to major events in American history, including the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and the Challenger explosion. Some people in the crowd cried when Turek delivered a prayer for the evening. Turek also brushed off the conspiracies about Charlie Kirk's death. He was with Charlie Kirk when he was shot. "Despite what you're hearing, I think we know who did it," Turek said. Lake Havasu resident Ryan Moldenauer, 18 years old, said he's been skeptical about the nature of Charlie Kirk's death. He decided to come to the show with his family because they were in the area for the next day's Arizona Cardinals NFL game. He pointed to right-wing podcasters such as Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, and Nick Fuentes, who have discussed questions about the government narrative about Charlie Kirk's killing. "I'm somewhere on the fence, but I'm kind of a buyer," Moldenauer said. "I don't think we have the whole story. I don't think we ever will." Moldenauer's family members were visiting from Las Vegas. Some people in the crowd came from other states, including Ohio, Michigan, Minnesota, Oregon, and Texas. Writer and podcaster Walter Kern, who Kelly interviewed during the show, told the crowd he went to Central High School in Phoenix in ninth grade, and he praised the diversity of the school. "When I was at Central High in Phoenix, we had so many gangs. We had Hopi gangs. They had Navajo gangs," Kern said. "We had diversity and a portrait of America that was far beyond, you know, even what we can imagine." Kern and Kelly also discussed whether aliens are real. "Very rarely, but somewhat commonly over the years, going back through human history, we have been visited by beings of other types," Kern said. Kelly said she hoped Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, would be abducted by aliens, and said that the Bay State lawmaker was probably part of the Hopi gang that Kern mentioned earlier. Cocktails on offer included the Hot Take Cosmo, the Podcast Punch, and the Soundcheck Smash. Carl Stenvall, 56 years old, attended with his sister, Carolyn Stenvall. He wore a white suit printed with an American flag and the word "Freedom" in black text. Underneath, he wore a white Freedom shirt, a replica of the shirt Charlie Kirk wore when he was killed. Many other attendees wore variations of the Freedom t-shirt in white, red, or turquoise. 2 months earlier, the Sun City siblings attended Charlie Kirk's public memorial at the nearby State Farm Stadium in Glendale. "We supported Charlie, so we're supporting his wife," Carolyn Stenvall said. "She's handled it so well. I just can't believe it. Just with seeing her husband shot like that, I can't even begin to imagine. I get chills." Dean and Terry Wiggins, a couple from East Mesa, praised Erica Kirk in an interview before the show. "Charlie Kirk is what brought me here, and just support for his wife," Terry Wiggins said. "Megyn Kelly, we like her too. Erica Kirk is why I'm here." Dean Wiggins, who wore a red Make America Charlie Kirk hat, said he viewed the slain activist as the epitome of free speech. He said Erica Kirk was courageous. "It's a hard thing to do to forgive somebody who killed your husband and the father of your two children, but that's what we're supposed to do," Dean Wiggins said. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, "Senator Kelly Decries GOP Silence on Trump Attack," written by Ronald Hansen. Senator Mark Kelly bemoaned an evident lack of concern from Republicans for the safety of himself and other Democrats after President Donald Trump accused them of sedition and suggested they should be hanged. Appearing November 23rd on CBS's Face the Nation, Kelly connected Trump's overheated social media messaging to the GOP's outrage over politically motivated violence after the September 10th assassination of Charlie Kirk. "What happened to that? I mean, that was 2 months ago," Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, said. "Where are they now? We've heard very little, basically crickets, from Republicans in the United States Congress about what the president has said about hanging members of Congress." Kelly said Trump tries to intimidate Republicans so they don't speak out. He also trashed the White House peace terms for Ukraine in its war with Russia. Kelly drew Trump's ire with a social media post featuring five other Democrats reminding members of the military they are not obligated to obey illegal orders. "We know you are under enormous pressure right now," the video message said. It did not specify what exactly the military might view as illegal orders, though it comes as the U.S. is drawing international attention for strikes on boats in international waters and pressuring Venezuela. "Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders," Kelly, a former Navy combat pilot and member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said. Trump issued a flurry of angry social media posts urging the Democrats to be tried for sedition and unsubtly echoing the punishment. "Seditious behavior, punishable by death," Trump wrote on November 20th. He toned down his comments in an interview with Fox News the next day. "I'm not threatening death, but I think they're in serious trouble," Trump said. Kelly, speaking with CBS's Margaret Brennan, noted his wife, former Representative Gabrielle Giffords, Democrat of Arizona, was shot in the head, and the couple takes security seriously. "I understand what political violence is," he said. "The president should as well. Just like Gabby, somebody tried to assassinate him, and he should understand that his words could have serious, serious consequences." "I think you know the president tries to intimidate Republicans," Kelly said. "He tries to intimidate Congress. He looks at government accountability as a nuisance. I think it's really important for people to understand, Margaret, that the message he sent a couple of days ago was that loyalty to the Constitution is now punishable by death. Those are serious words coming from the President of the United States." The meaning of the Democrats' message has remained unclear. Kelly said the UK has pulled back intelligence sharing as the Pentagon has conducted missile strikes on boats in international waters that it claims are drug couriers. But he also said Trump's first term included his desire for the military to kill the families of terrorists and to have them shoot the legs of protesters in America. Kelly said the administration is tying themselves in knots, trying to explain why what they're doing with regards to these drug boats is legal, and it's questionable at best. The Navy has moved an aircraft carrier into the Caribbean, increasing tensions with Venezuela. The State Department does not recognize Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro as having legitimately won re-election last year. Speaking of a 28-point peace plan outlined by Trump for Ukraine that includes ceding territory to Russia, Kelly said it was essentially what Russian President Vladimir Putin wants. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky publicly agonized about the Trump plan. Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice, either loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner, either a difficult 28 points or an extremely difficult winter, he said. That's Putin's plan. That is a very good deal for Russia, Kelly said. It's a horrible deal for Ukraine, for our allies, and even for our own national security. If Putin gets the chance with that deal to rearm, rebuild his economy, and gain territory, by the way, that's what he wanted, then the Baltics, Poland, Romania, and all those other countries down the line are a threat. Putin has said the peace proposal could form the basis for a final agreement, but he did not embrace it in full. The next article is entitled, U.S. and Ukraine Discuss Reworked Peace Plan, written by Max Hunder, Emma Farge, and Olivia de Poitevin. U.S. and Ukrainian officials sought to narrow the gaps between them on November 24th over a plan to end the war in Ukraine after agreeing to modify a U.S. proposal that Kyiv and its European allies saw as a Kremlin wish list. In a joint statement, Washington and Kyiv said they had drafted a refined peace framework after talks in Geneva on November 23rd. Though there were no specifics, the dialogue received a cautious welcome from some of Ukraine's allies. Ukraine's delegation to the talks with U.S. officials in Switzerland was returning home on November 24th to report back, President Volodymyr Zelensky said. President Donald Trump hinted at new progress. Is it really possible that big progress is being made in peace talks between Russia and Ukraine? Don't believe it until you see it, but something good just may be happening, Trump wrote on Truth Social. Later at the White House, spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt said there were a couple of points of disagreement remaining, but we're confident we'll be able to work through those. She said Trump wanted a deal as quickly as possible, but there was no meeting currently scheduled between Trump and Zelensky. Zelensky said in his nightly video address that the plan has now incorporated correct points, but sensitive issues were to be discussed with Trump. Since the summer, U.S. policy toward the war in Ukraine has zigzagged. Trump's hastily arranged Alaska summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin spurred worries that Washington was prepared to accept many Russian demands, but ultimately resulted in more U.S. pressure on Russia. The latest 28-point peace proposal again caught many in the U.S. government, Kyiv, and Europe off guard, and prompted fresh concerns that the Trump administration might be willing to push Ukraine to sign a peace deal heavily tilted toward Moscow. The plan would require Ukraine to cede more territory, accept curbs on its military, and bar it from ever joining NATO, conditions Kyiv has long rejected as tantamount to surrender. It would also do nothing to allay broader European fears of further Russian aggression. Ukraine's European allies drew up a counterproposal which, according to a copy reviewed by Reuters, would halt fighting at present front lines, leaving discussions of territory for later, and include a NATO-style U.S. security guarantee for Ukraine. Moscow, which described the initial reported U.S. plan as a potential basis for an agreement, rejected the European version. The European plan, at first glance, is completely unconstructive and does not work for us, Kremlin foreign policy aide Yuri Ushakov told reporters in Moscow. Zelensky could struggle to get Ukrainians to swallow a deal viewed as selling out their interests. Trump's special plan is, in general, a capitulation for Ukraine, said Angelika Yurkovich, a 62-year-old civil servant in Kyiv. I think the Ukrainian people will not agree. Even if they sign, it needs to be implemented. The Ukrainian people will be the ones to do it, and they do not agree with this. After talks on November 23rd, no public statement was released on how the revised plan would handle contentious issues such as how to guarantee Ukraine's security against future Russian threats, or how to fund the rebuilding of Ukraine. Zelensky said negotiations were ongoing. We all continue working with partners, especially the United States, to look for compromises that will strengthen but not weaken us, Zelensky said via video link from a separate meeting of Ukraine's allies in Sweden. Trump, who returned to office this year pledging to quickly end the war, has reoriented U.S. policy away from staunch support for Kyiv toward accepting some of Russia's justifications for its 2022 invasion. Zelensky could travel to the United States as soon as this week to discuss the most sensitive aspects of the plan with Trump, according to sources familiar with the matter. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.